News. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. Listen to the youth. That's the message Oakland students want you to hear in Homeroom, the new documentary by award-winning director Peter Nix and award-winning producer Ryan Coogler. The film follows Oakland High School's class of 2020 as students confront an unprecedented year. They face anxiety over college applications and growing uncertainty from the COVID pandemic. They also fought tirelessly to eliminate their district's $4 million police force from their school as the district faced budget cuts. Last June, after the police killing of George Floyd, the school board unanimously passed the George Floyd resolution to eliminate the Oakland Schools Police Department. But it was a tough road. Here is the trailer for the new documentary, Homeroom.
Welcome. We are a part of the Youth Outreach Unit of the Oakland Police Department.
Do you think it's necessary to make assumptions about anybody you come in contact with?
Good question.
My name is Zenosin Garibo, and I'm one of the two students that represent all 36,000 students in our district. We have some cuts which will impact our students.
The district spends $6 million on police.
We don't really feel safe with police. It could be very triggering.
I don't really feel like they do anything to serve or protect us.
Let's go, gentlemen. The bell has rung.
I would love for you to come to a board meeting because I don't be seeing young people.
We should cut police from our schools and redirect that money into programs that are going to support young people.
Time to make history, stand with us black and brown students. It's not tomorrow, it's today.
That motion was not adopted.
My family is undocumented. Me being close to police means that I'm putting their life in this country at risk.
We made it, we celebrated and did it once more.
The Black Panthers was founded in Oakland. A lot of things that they fought for were simple, as access to education.
Get it like we get it all our lives.
When you've been treated so poorly by the people meant to protect you, just give up.
The superintendent has closed schools.
Coronavirus is different when you want to go do things.
I feel like I'm putting my family at jeopardy, but this ain't over.
We spread our message by standing together. That's how they hear us.
Always remember, ain't no power like the power of the youth. Because the power of the youth don't stop.
This is history in the making, y'all.
You have had a front seat to the turmoil that's been going on for years. Well, I feel like this is a different fire that it has been lit.
Black lives, black future, black graduates, black children.
That is the trailer for the new documentary Homeroom, which follows Oakland High School's class of 2020 as students confront an unprecedented year. Homeroom premieres on Hulu tomorrow, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Peter Nix, an Emmy award-winning director and cinematographer at Open Hood, a nonprofit founded in 2009 that uses storytelling to create stronger, more active, and more connected communities. Peter has directed and produced a trilogy of films examining three public institutions in Oakland. The Waiting Room took us inside Oakland's Highland Hospital. The Force examined the Oakland Police Department. And his latest documentary, Homeroom, takes a deep dive into the Oakland Unified School District. And we had Peter on to talk about The Waiting Room and The Force. And we're very happy to have him back to talk about Homeroom. Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for this great film.
Hey, Rose. Thanks so much.
Well, it's great to have you, Peter. We want to start off by sending condolences to you and your family. The film is dedicated to your daughter, Karina Nix, who sadly passed away in September 2019 when she was just 16 years old. And you wrote about what happened for Filmmaker Magazine. You write that She passed shortly after you all began filming, and she'd been battling anxiety and bipolar disease since she was a young girl. Would you be okay telling us more about her?
Yeah, you know, I think we're going to be trying to, in some ways, tell Karina's story for the rest of our lives and also be guided by her story and what she has to teach us. And clearly she came to this earth for the short time that she did in only the way that she could, but she remains, you know, in spirit teaching us. And I think to some degree, the story of the young people in this movie is her story. She was to graduate in 2020. Many of these kids in the film were at least one person removed from her. And so when she passed away, I had to make the decision whether to continue making the film. And it was a very difficult decision. I did consider, you know, stopping. At this point, we had, you know, hired the whole crew and we had begun working. And I ultimately decided that I would continue, not so much to have the film honor her so much as to almost give myself something to do to be occupied, because I, you know, the grief was so profound and continues to be. I just wanted something to do. And as we moved along in the movie, and initially the conception of the film was because of the challenge that we had getting help for Karina. She had been struggling for many years, and we were navigating the adolescent mental health system, which is completely broken. The initial idea of the movie was to explore the emotional lives of young people growing up in a rapidly changing world. And she was one of those young people. Many of the kids in this film were her peers. And they had a counseling center at Oakland High called CHOP 55, which was a place where kids, young kids dealing with depression and anxiety could come and talk in private to counselors. And many of these kids didn't have health insurance. Many of these kids didn't want to talk to their parents about what they were going through, but they needed a safe place to express, you know. And this was all before COVID. You know, this was all before, you know, everything that transpired in the year that we were filming, that young people, you know, we noticed that young people were really struggling. And so that was the initial focus of the project. And of course, as the year began turning, everything kind of changed and shifted.
You know, this is so, so important, Peter. And again, we're so, so sorry. To focus on mental health and young people, as you write in Filmmaker Magazine, your wife and you exhausted the resources of a broken mental health system to get your daughter treatment. You say that you were well-resourced, you had access to information, your wife actually works at Highland Hospital, but you couldn't seem to get help. And along the way, you realized how so many families without resources are raising children with undiagnosed and untreated mental health issues while also trying to navigate the system. And we heard about this in the film. Some of the students said, you know, our friends drop out and they're smarter than we are, but they cannot get the help that they need.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was a insight that I've carried with me since, I mean, my wife inspired me in some ways to make The Waiting Room, and she's a refugee, and she has a very personal connection to a lot of the patient population there who are refugees or non-English language you know, patients who come in who are just trying to, you know, get by, who are trying to navigate various things of life that we all are trying to navigate, and those barriers, you know, how to sort of transcend, you know, those barriers in a system that's not really designed to accommodate them is really a larger theme of my work, and also examining that relationship between our institutions and community. What our communities are diverse, and in Oakland in particular is a very diverse community with great promise, but also with facing a lot of challenges. You know, our family is a mixed race family. It's a very diverse family. I was adopted in 1968. My birth mother was white. My birth father was black. Her family threatened to disown her if she married my birth father, so she made the difficult decision to give me up for adoption. I was raised by a Black family outside of Boston, went to white private schools, ended up at Howard University. Met Bana, who's a refugee from Laos. And so our stories are a collection of you know, to some degree, loss and trauma, but also the story of a increasingly changing America. And when we, you know, started raising our kids and trying to understand, you know, what's the story that we're telling them, and what's the story of our family? What are the values of our family? Trying to identify that, we have to sort of identify it being in the box of a society that, you know, has certain systems and structures that it asks our kids to sort of go through, and school is one of them, and test scores, SAT scores, determining value of students and how we communicate to them what their value is. These students, I think a lot of young people get the message that they're not smart, that they're not capable if they don't get good grades or good SAT scores. And that's a very corrosive message. Having police in the schools, what message does that send? And then allowing the students to speak for themselves and say, this isn't something that makes us feel protected. Actually, this is something that makes us feel threatened. And, you know, when you're trying to come of age and just grow as a young person, you're dealing with adolescence. That in of itself is a massive challenge. And to layer all these things on top of that is remarkable. And so part of what we wanted to try to do with the film is articulate, you know, who these young people were and how, in the wake of such tremendous loss, they nevertheless found their voice, and that resilience and strength is something that we're, I think, a lot of adults are missing and not sort of fully understanding that these young people are in possession of.
It's such a good point, because we hear about their struggles, but we rarely hear directly from them. How did you get such incredible access? It felt like we were there at school with these students in your film.
Well, I mean, that to some degree, that's the value of what I've been doing with the arc of the work for so many years in one American city, telling this sort of grand narrative of Oakland. And you develop relationships, you know. You can't get access to the forest without the waiting room, you know, and, you know, in making the decision to step into the Oakland Unified School District, we were able to hold community screenings at the New Parkway and other places to gather teachers, parents, young people, to allow them to watch our films, to question me about my intentions, to explore and to allow me to gather insight into what the film should be. So those were all very valuable. That whole relationship that had been built over many years with the city as a whole, but also individuals within the city. The mayor of Oakland, Libby Schaff, has been a huge supporter of mine. Various, you know, city leaders are familiar with my work. And so all that, I think, added up to a foundation of trust that allowed us to begin making the film. But despite that, it's a daily process of trust building with the teachers within the school. I mean, the superintendent and the mayor can sign off on the project, but you still have to have tremendous respect and understanding for what it means to bring a camera into a school, the vulnerability of asking people to share their stories. That's something that, you know, we take very seriously, and that is a sort of day-by-day process of discussion and trust building.
And then we also meet some of the families of the students. We go home with them. We follow them throughout their day. Speaking of listening to students and learning more about their struggles, we'll talk about the movement to eliminate the police force. But first, let's talk about just what students are dealing with in Oakland. Let's hear a clip. This is from Homeroom. This is a new documentary by today's guest, award-winning director Peter Nix, and it follows Oakland High School's class of 2020 as students confront an unprecedented year. And in this clip, you will hear students discussing their college application, personal essays, and just explaining their daily lives.
Not easy. I mean, easy. It's like easy to talk about, but like, when you trying to like really explain to somebody like your life, is kind of like, nah, I can't. It's kind of hard to think about.
I said, just like this, bro. I started, I said, they be shooting at night. Say they be shot. I said, it be needles. Said we broke as hell. And Shirley said that. I should have talked about that gentrification, bro.
Look, I say, in the last year, I've been moving house like three moves in the last year because of, what would I say? The unstable house market of Oakland. Something like that.
Talk about how gentrification rising and you got to move everywhere.
It's crazy. Talk about how you see white people like in the 60s now. Crazy.
You motherfucking house, $1 million, bro.
Oh, the house by your house? It's crazy. Oh, and I live way farther from the school now, man. So I got to get up hella earlier.
I should have talked about that. How the schools that's closer to you is like trash. Like they just don't care.
Students discussing their college application, personal essays, talking about their everyday lives in the new documentary Homeroom, which premieres on Hulu tomorrow, August 12th. And we're discussing it with award-winning director Peter Nix. I thought that was so telling on so many levels, Peter. Hearing the students talk about having to move three times because the home, they're getting priced out of their home. And he now lives even further from the school, so he has to get up early to go. And then talking about how the schools in the new neighborhoods are, quote, trash. I just think that says so much about where we are right now.
Yeah, and I think that's it's such a strong theme that's sort of moving through, I think, the film, but also, you know, as parents, as educators, I think we struggle oftentimes to really listen to our kids, to hear our kids. And this notion of validation is something that we really wanted to step into. And my process of storytelling in making The Waiting Room, it was a profound moment where we had numerous conversations with people stuck in that waiting room without the camera, just meeting people. And one of the first conversations actually I had was with a young girl who'd been shot outside Edna Brewer Middle School, where she was a student. And she wasn't in class, you know, getting educated, coming of age. She was stuck in a hospital waiting room, you know, waiting to get treatment for a gunshot wound. And I knew at that moment that I couldn't tell her full story in that film. And that we needed to, you know, there needed to be more of a larger framework for exploring that.
What else really struck you about what these kids go through on a regular basis that we don't hear about? Because, I mean, right now, if you turn on the television, the storyline about the Bay Area is how expensive it is and how there's crime. Those are the main two storylines. But you really dig so deep in this film and talk about just what these kids, these young, almost young adults are really dealing with. And everybody has a different story, of course. But what really stood out to you about what we're not hearing when you turn on, for example, the TV news?
Well, I think the most significant thing, which ironically the film doesn't delve as much into because of the nature of what happened during the year that we were filming with COVID and with the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement and this initiative that these student leaders were so focused on. What we noticed right away, and what obviously myself as a parent I've been dealing with, was trying to understand the emotional lives of our kids and trying to understand the impact of a rapidly changing world on them with social media and not understanding it and not knowing, you know, how to help them and how to support them. And so we had spent this time in Shop 55 initially listening to young people share about what they were going through emotionally with depression, anxiety, with, you know, generational trauma. These are a lot of kids who come from, or non-English speakers who come from another country, who come from the foster system, who were adopted, who come from war-torn countries or in their neighborhood have lost friends to gun violence. That stood out right away. And that was our initial focus, was exploring that little corner of Oakland High, Shop 55, the Counseling Center. And then that you know, the focus shifted away later. But the other thing we noticed was that this interesting dialectic, this interesting dialectic of social media being a problem in their lives, but also being a space and a tool which dramatically empowered them. And I think that's something that adults don't fully understand, because adults, parents and teachers, are not generally privy to the spaces in which young people are coming of age now. Basically on their own, akin to Lord of the Flies, where they're in these spaces, learning things, absorbing information, supporting each other, encouraging each other, growing together, organizing together. We started to get glimmers of that when COVID hit in particular, and that was something that we also wanted to explore.
The scenes, the social media scenes, were just amazing. You have so many shots of students looking at their phones, photos, videos, just scrolling. You have one scene where a student receives a phone call during class. She leaves the classroom and seems really irritated with the person calling her. And then there are scenes of students watching videos of police violently grabbing, or in one case, choking a young person of color. They watched videos of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd being killed. I mean, this is really a new phenomenon where these kids have their phones in class and they can, you know, hang out with their friend who maybe is in another class and just scroll, but then also see really brutal, violent content of people who look like them being grabbed, or in the case of George Floyd, killed. What stood out for you? Can you just give us more insight about, you know, the conversations you may have had with the students about social media and how it affects them?
It's just so ubiquitous in their lives, and for good and bad. And the amplification of it is undeniable. And, you know, whether or not, you know, seeing those videos of violence, it both informs them, but it also, it creates a sense of anxiety, I think, in their lives that could, you could argue, is an amplification beyond the reality. But I'm always amazed. I talk to my son and I ask him if he's heard of something, and he's like, oh yeah, he's always a step or two ahead of me. He has heard, and these kids know the news of the day globally, what's happening locally, what's happening in news, sports, entertainment, politics. These kids have that information filtered to them in real time through a variety of platforms, from TikTok to, it's mostly TikTok and Instagram that they get, I think, their information. And I don't think adults have a full understanding of the breadth and scope of the information that they have available to them. And then they react to each other on that information. We didn't witness really deep, meaningful, you know, conversations about that information. They're just absorbing it. And, you know, and then how it manifests in their lives is going to depend upon their own individual paths or context or situations in broader society, like it happened in the film with the emergence of, you know, the situations with Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. Then they are faced with an opportunity to reflect on all that information that they've absorbed, and then decide what to do with it. And then now they have the tools to take action, to organize, to march, to do it in their own way. And that's completely absent any adult supervision whatsoever. And I find that to be probably the most profound generational shift that's happened in some time.
And then, of course, during COVID, for so many, social media was really all they had to connect with their friends.
That's right. And I think that speaks to, in some ways, how social media can be healing for young people. It can be also very damaging and corrosive, but it can also be healing. It's a space for them to come together, to communicate with each other, to see each other. And that's really the confounding thing that we're facing, you know, the adults, you know, the teachers and the parents who are trying to, you know, guide, you know, our students and our kids through those spaces. It's a very difficult, you know, confluence of positive and negative. And so that's just something that's the reality of the world, you know, that we live in today. And that's something that's going to require ongoing investigation and conversation.
Today, we are talking about a new documentary, Homeroom, which follows Oakland High School's class of 2020 as they face an unprecedented year. Homeroom premieres on Hulu tomorrow, August 12th. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Peter Nix, an Emmy Award-winning director and cinematographer. Homeroom is his latest documentary in a trilogy of films examining three public institutions in Oakland. The Waiting Room took us inside Oakland's Highland Hospital. The Force examined the Oakland Police Department, and Homeroom takes a deep dive into the Oakland Unified School District. And coming up after a break, we'll also be joined by Denilson Garibo, who is, or I should say was, because he just graduated. He was a student at Oakland High School and is featured in the new film Homeroom. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about a new documentary, Homeroom, which follows Oakland High School's class of 2020 as they face an unprecedented year. It's really an incredible film that really does lift up the voices of students. We often hear about students, but we rarely hear directly from them. And they say it's time to listen to the youth. Homeroom premieres on Hulu tomorrow, August 12th. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Peter Nix, an Emmy Award-winning director and cinematographer at Open Hood. Peter is director of Homeroom. His other films are The Waiting Room and The Force. And now I would like to welcome Denilson Garibo. Denilson was student director of All City Council at Oakland High School. He represented Oakland High School students on the city council, including 36,000 students in the district. He graduated in 2020 and is featured in the new film Homeroom. Hi, Denilson. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I wish we could all be in studio. I'd give you a big hug. It was great to get to know you and learn about the amazing work that you did at Oakland High School. What was it like to be filmed and to then now see yourself on the big screen?
Honestly, it's a very surreal moment, like just feeling, because just as an Oakland student, you never have a chance to get these type of opportunities of just being, you know, recorded for a film and to just shed light on the issues that we as Oakland students face is something really important. And it just brings me so much happiness. And I'm so proud of, you know, of the way it all came about. And I even cried watching the film of how just powerful it is and how well represents Oakland students. So it's just a lot of emotions, a lot of positive emotions coming through.
Denilson, what's so amazing about the film is we watch all of you just talk about everyday life, but also organize. What are your thoughts about the young people you see in the media? Let's just say, you know, broadcast media, mainstream media. How do you think young people are portrayed today?
That's a very great question. I feel like young people today, as we are witnessing through social media, is that, you know, we're showing that we have the ability to create a change in our world, our society and communities. And, you know, we want a better world because in the end, a lot of the decisions that are being made by adults are affecting our future, our education and our lives. And we're tired of like hearing such things from adults like, oh, you're too young for this. Oh, you'll understand when you grow up, but we're not trying to get it when we grow up. We're understanding it right now in this moment because it is happening right now. So that's why it is important for a lot of youth to get involved in the decision-making process that happens in the education system and all these other stuff. So And that's exactly what we're doing. That's exactly what we're doing. As we see on social media, there's a lot of youth leaders that, you know, we're seeing. And I'm just so proud that that's happening.
You know, one of the themes in the film is the effort by the students to get more funding for supportive services like counselors and mental health resources. Can you tell us more about the importance of that, given everything kids are dealing with, everyday stress, but also in the case of one of the kids we meet, he had to move 3 times in 1 year because his family got priced out of their neighborhood, and now he lives further from school. One of the other kids talked about hearing shooting at night, seeing needles on the ground. I mean, these kinds of stories are so important, but the resources are also just as important. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. And that's exactly what happens when we have underfunded school districts. For example, we have Oakland Unified School District trying to prioritize, you know, school police. And that should never have been the case, because we cannot have schools that underline a system that criminalizes Black and Brown students and makes them feel unsafe to the point where they cannot learn. And that continues to happen on schools that are underfunded. Like I said, school districts like OUSD prioritize having more budget cuts to the programming and services that our students need. And to prepare our students for college and a sustainable life after high school, there needs to be more investment in our education. This looks like more restorative justice programs, mental health services, and more teachers who look like their students and who can meaningfully engage students of color and guide them on the right track. You know, similar to what we saw in the documentary, I remember the scene where it was, you know, many of our students talking about how low their SAT score was. And that's not a representation of how smart we are, but that's a representation of the education that the district is giving us. The low type of education that the district is giving us, because of lack of resources and poor quality education, we are unable to excel in SATs or ACTs. We don't have the privilege of having private tutors or access to materials that other youth in more rich areas benefit mm-hmm. from. Mm-hmm. And that's important to talk about.
Oh, so important to talk about, especially as more and more people are going to private schools. Peter, about $4 million of the Oakland Unified School District's budget went to hiring a police force. And Oakland was one of the few districts in the country that had its own police force. It was the only city in Alameda County to have its own police force. How much did you know about this before you started filming?
You know, the first time this actually dawned on me was when we were releasing The Force, and I had traveled to Miami to screen The Force. I was going to a screening, and I remember seeing a police car, and on that it said like Miami-Dade Unified School District Police, and I'd never seen anything like that before. And that was the beginning of my understanding that there were school districts around the country. Oakland is certainly not the only one. I wouldn't say that this is widespread, but there are a surprising number of school districts that, you know, have a budget and employ a dedicated police force that is not part of the local city police force. And that was the realization of that. I think, as we started understanding what these students were doing, and there were two main initiatives that the students were pushing. One was to eliminate the school police, but the other, which was just as important that we weren't able to fully articulate in the movie for editorial reasons, was that the students successfully pushed through an initiative to lower the voting age to 16 so that students in the Oakland Unified School District, 16 and older, could vote for members of the school board. And that was an initiative that Dennelson and his cohort successfully pushed through. And it speaks to the importance of these police forces impact the kids in ways that I don't think adults fully understand in terms of the emotional impact, trying to deal with all the things that Dennelson is talking about, housing insecurity, food insecurity, you know, the kids who are in the foster system, kids who are dealing with generational trauma, who are just trying to move through and come of age and achieve their goals. They also have to deal with seeing police officers on their campus and what's the emotional impact of that. That I don't think is something that has been fully examined in the context of both mental health and of you know, school policy.
Right. Dennelson, can you tell us what interactions are like with police and students? I mean, do you see them or did you see them on a regular basis? Are they always present?
At certain schools, they used to be always present. I remember sometimes at Oakland High, they'd be, you know, on our park, on our basketball fields. And, you know, that sort of triggered many students, including myself, because it's like you don't know what they're thinking when they look at you. You don't know if they're going to stop you and ask any questions that's going to put you in harm. I remember one time I was getting out of school early and there was a police car parked outside in front of the school. And he literally stopped me and said, "Hey, like, what are you doing close to the school?" Thinking, I don't know, I wasn't a student. And, you know, these types of situations shouldn't be happening. And that's what sort of encouraged me to prevent that from happening and fighting alongside the Black Organizing Project. So, like, many Black and Brown students shouldn't be able to feel like that, shouldn't be racial profiled in a space that's supposed to be safe for them.
And Dennelson, as you say in the film, you came to the U.S. as an undocumented child with your mom. So when you interact with police, there's a lot at stake there beyond what's just obvious.
Yes, exactly. That's mainly why I was fighting to eliminate school police so hard, along with the Black Organizing Project and many students, because of my story, my family, and what comes with being undocumented. Like, the challenges are so hard, and just the thought of, you know, being stopped by police and just being incarcerated for no reason, and to the point where you get deported. That's something that it's heartbreaking, you know, and that's why we were able to eliminate school police, because there are many students who feel like this, but there are many students who carry different challenges, such as being undocumented and, you know, the trauma that some students might carry with us police overall. And yeah.
Dennelson Garibo was student director of All City Council at Oakland High School. He represented 36,000 students in his district. He graduated in 2020 and is now attending Long Beach State. He's featured in the new film Homeroom, which premieres on Hulu tomorrow, August 12th. We're also joined by Peter Nix, an Emmy award-winning director and cinematographer. I want to play another clip. This one was just so interesting. The Office of the Chief of Police has open houses with students. At Oakland High School met with Oakland Police as part of their youth outreach unit. And the way that it was framed is that this is the opportunity for students to be able to ask police officers questions. Dennelson, is this pretty common in high school? Do most classes go to the police department to ask police officers questions?
That is not common at all.
Oh, okay.
I think it just happened because I don't even know why it happened, to be honest. I think it was mainly because of the fight that was happening with the Black Organizing Project, and many students might have advocated to have a conversation with police because they wanted to get to know more of, like, why do they do what they do. And I think it was an academy. I think it was the Law and Justice Academy, the pathway that they have in Oakland High, that was able to push that through to have that meeting with police. But that is not something on the regular that we see in our schools.
Hmm. Well, let's hear a clip. This is students from Oakland High asking Oakland police officers questions. And this is a clip from Homeroom.
In this field, do you think it's necessary to make assumptions about anybody you come in contact with?
To make assumptions? Good question. We'll hear and we'll see things in the news and media that talk about how, well, the officer walked up and grabbed onto this person and took him to jail based on a very simple fact. Okay, he took him to jail because he was wearing a black hoodie and someone got robbed down the street in a black hoodie. The narrative that you guys are receiving on social media, in the movies, in the books, says that we are looking forward every day to blasting somebody and smoking up somebody. And that's just not the case. Most of us will go our entire careers and never have to fire our weapons at another human being. That's the facts. It's not what you guys have heard or what our perceptions are. Out of 1 million police officers in the United States, is it realistic to believe that all 1 million are going to have strong ethical and moral values and always do the right thing? Right? I still have that expectation, but I'm oftentimes disappointed by police officers' actions across the nation, but never more so than when it happens here in Oakland, California.
There are a lot of students who have PTSD when it comes to police officers because they have had traumatic experience. There are police officers always, like, patrolling around communities that they live in. They see people that look like them get arrested, family members get arrested, like, unjustly. They see them at their public transportation routes. They see them everywhere. And then, like, school is supposed to be a safe place, and then you see them there as well. It's like being around them all the time is like overwhelming me. Then it stops them from wanting to go to school. And then when they don't go to school, then they're labeled as bad kids and stuff like that, gang members and like low lives. But it's like when you've been like treated so poorly by the people meant to protect you because it's the color of your skin or like the money you have in your pocket, it's like you don't want to be around that no more. You just give up.
That is a clip from the documentary Homeroom, Oakland High School students meeting with Oakland police as part of their youth outreach unit. Peter, that was really an amazing scene. Can you just tell us what it was like to film that? Because the look on the students' faces, there is just so much, what is the right word? Distrust, sadness, yeah. Anger, all of it.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, when we heard that the, Denelson alluded to the pathway, the school had these different pathways where students who are interested in things like, you know, criminal justice or healthcare, they can take a track on these pathways and then they get opportunities like this to, they also have a program where they take students over to Highland Hospital. And we missed the Highland Hospital one, but we heard about both of them and we just thought that it'd be an interesting way to tie together the films in some way or reflect the trilogy or bring in, you know, the fact that we had just made a film about the Oakland Police Department, which was fundamentally about trust between the community and the police, showing how the Oakland Police was trying to repair that damaged trust, trying to reform and what that looked like. This moment really was an extension of that, and I think, but also illuminating the disconnect that there is between not just young people and adults, but in this case, young people and the police. And I do believe that those officers were trying to connect with them, trying to, in some ways, just communicate, hey, we're trying here. We you know, you don't, do you understand us? You know, I don't know if they fully were in the right mindset to simply listen, but clearly that's what they open that opportunity to listen, and oftentimes the police don't get credit for that. And so that scene was really meant to articulate both sides of that. And it was really obvious just seeing their posture, their body language, how uncomfortable they were. But it was also, for me, really remarkable the courage that they had to speak truth to their experience directly to these officers at that age. And when I was at that age, I don't think I was in possession of that degree of courage. Maybe partly because of the way that I grew up, but these kids have been facing these issues for so long and have experienced the presence of police in their communities in so many different ways that are negative, that it's very hard for them to hear the message that I think that those officers were trying to communicate in that moment. Whether or not the officers understood and internalized what the young people were saying is a story for another day, and I think also requires some more exploration.
Right. Dennelson, what would you add? Do you remember having conversations with...
So are you cut off, Tina? Do I remember having conversations with police? Got you. No, I don't remember ever having conversations with police. My conversations were mostly with the superintendent and the school board of education, how to eliminate school police. From what I remember, school police, I never, with All City Council Student Union, we never had a conversation with school police, nor did they ever try to reach out to the All City Council Student Union of how we felt about them and why we did. Yeah, because our conversations were mostly happening with the superintendent. But honestly, I loved that scene so much. That's one of my like top favorite scenes, because it just shows how we just come from a place of resilience and determination, where we have been taught that we are the only ones who have the responsibility for what we believe is right. And that's exactly what she was telling the police. Like, she was telling them that she did not feel protected when they were around. And that's so powerful, because it's like, if that system can't protect us, then all we got is ourselves. All we got is the protection from our community within each other. And that's all we need to overcome that trauma.
You want me to ask Donaldson a question? So Donaldson, one of the things that I talk about a lot is, and I think is determinant of the outcomes for young people in their lives, is that internal narrative. You know, how you feel about yourself and your future, how your identity on some level, beyond just race or class, but you're just your identity and your sense of purpose, how you see yourself, and that is really important. And if you look at sort of the outcomes of students, particularly students that come from communities where there's a lot of messages coming in that are contrary to positivity. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you see yourself and your peers in that respect. Has social media helped you build a better sense of yourself? Or has it been more corrosive? Or how would you describe sort of where you're at and how you feel your peers are at in terms of your optimism for yourself, your internal narrative, and then what challenges that?
Honestly, I feel like I have come a long way in when, discussing my identity and like my optimism, because even back then, being part of All City Council Student Union, we were doing a lot. Like you mentioned, the Oakland Youth Vote. And then we started working on the George Floyd resolution. And that was a lot of work for us to keep up with, because not only we were doing that, but we were also having to focus on school and have our units ready and able to graduate on time. But at the same time, mm-hmm. from what I felt, it was like, am I doing enough? Is this work? Like, I didn't feel like I was doing enough. I felt like I needed to do more, get more involved with the community, because I just wanted to support my community of East Oakland. And even though I was overworking myself, I never felt like it was enough, because I always wanted to become a great leader in my community along my peers, and I wanted to set a good example for them. So I overworked myself a lot because I didn't want it to be perceived as someone who did not put in the effort into, you know, making the change in our communities. So now that I look back at it, on it, I feel like I did what I had to do. I did great things along with my peers, and you know, we did enough for the current governing board of All City Council Student Union to follow up that movement, because, you know, it never stops, you know, and I'm just so proud that in the end we were able to do big things, and it just brings so much happiness and joy to that.
Well, Donaldson, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you're now doing great things at Long Beach State, and we'd love to have you back to talk about what your experience has been like there. Donaldson Garibo is featured in the new film Homeroom. He represented Oakland High School students on the city council. Donaldson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. And Peter Nix is an Emmy Award-winning director and cinematographer at Open Hood. His latest film is Homeroom, and you can watch it tomorrow, August 12th on Hulu. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Peter, thank you again for this great film, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And again, our thoughts are with your family. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. I am sorry for that technical glitch. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.